We've developed some relationships with people and legislators and journalists over our short time here. And we like to check in with Josh Elliott from time to time, state rep. Give us your district again. What towns you got?
88th District, Hamden exclusively.
It's just Hamden?
Just Hamden.
Keep it focused.
It's easy. It's nice.
Yeah. What I want to, first of all, how you doing?
Life's good.
Yeah?
Had a rough primary.
Then, yeah, it was nasty. What happened?
It was pretty personal. It wasn't really based on policy. It was based on...
Who was your opponent?
It was my mayor's ex-husband.
Okay.
And it was about the fact that I did not sign a ceasefire resolution. Agree with the ceasefire, wasn't signing any resolutions. And
like in Gaza?
Like in Gaza. Not really relevant to state-level politics. So that's what it became about, and it was fine. I worked really hard, and I had the biggest win in Greater New Haven in the last 50 years.
And you have a Republican opponent coming up?
None.
Okay, so that was your election.
It was my election. I have some very strong thoughts in the fact that we don't have nearly enough contested seats.
So this was bothering me, too. I think we were talking, maybe it was in West Hartford, where all the Democrats are unopposed for state office.
And Hamden, too, by the way. All five reps, we don't have challengers.
And I believe, like, I really believe in competitive government. I'm unaffiliated. I'm an independent. But I think the Republican Party needs to be stronger. But what I've noticed, we've done this thing called darting across Connecticut, where mm-hmm. I go to a different town. I just throw the dart at that map right there, and wherever okay. it lands, we go. There are a lot of good town leaders who are Republicans who have political talent.
Sure.
They just don't want to go past the town.
Yeah.
But there aren't enough Republicans running for office. And you're saying that even though Democrats might even increase, that it's not a good thing.
I 100% agree. I think you have to earn the job. That's why I told constituents all summer, it's not mine to own, it's mine to earn. And so that's why I was happy to have a primary challenger. It did in very many ways ruin my summer. At the same time, this is the work.
Yeah. Kept you on your toes.
Yeah.
But what do you think the problem is with... the opposite party? Like, what is it with Republicans? Because I think there was a lot of dissatisfaction with Biden per se on the national level, and obviously Trump is a harder sell in Connecticut than it is in other parts of the country. But what is plaguing the Republican Party in Connecticut?
I just think that, especially during the pandemic, we brought a lot of people in from New York. And I think on the west coast of the state, we got a lot bluer. So we have seats in Fairfield, seats in Greenwich that we have never won before. And so right now, we're not playing defense. We're playing offense, and we're trying to just increase our wins. I just think that also with the redistricting that happened just a few years ago, a lot of incumbency protection. I am guilty of that just as anybody else is. It's a bipartisan process. So Republicans and Democrats are in the room. And what ends up happening is these slightly red districts get a little bit redder and the slightly blue districts get a little bit bluer.
Right.
And then it just means that if you are a person who is thinking about running for office, you're looking at the metrics of the district, you say, why would I even bother?
We're going to talk about the budget. We're going to talk about potentially the movement on the fiscal guardrails. We'll talk a little presidential politics, early voting, some gubernatorial issues to talk about with Josh as well, who has been very transparent about his possible ambitions. We're back here with Josh Elliott, Democratic state rep from Hamden. Presidential politics-wise, like, I'm nervous either way. Regardless of who wins, I'm nervous. I'm nervous for a lot of different reasons on both sides. But, obviously, we know who's going to win Connecticut in the presidential race. I know who you're going to vote for.
Yes.
But how do you feel about everything that's sort of happening at the national level? Like, what are your thoughts?
As a Democrat, I feel very anxious, and I try not to look at those polls because, boy, have they not been reliable for a while now.
You hope they're not reliable for your perspective because it's not positive.
It's not positive. Right. And I was a delegate for the Harris campaign. I was in Chicago, and... those 4 days were pretty electric, and the few weeks following were pretty amazing, and now we've settled back into normal.
So what's not resonating with her? Like, what for the independent voter or the moderate, the race is so tight, but she has struggled to parlay that momentum from Chicago into sustained, you know, advantage? What is it? What's her blind spot?
I'm not sure if there's necessarily a blind spot. It's the fact that there's so much fundraising that needs to be done. There's so many events that she needs to go to. And I think that they recognize that exactly what you're saying was a problem, that people didn't really feel like they knew who she was. You can't tell who somebody is by how they address a group of 5,000 people. And so she's been doing the podcast. She's been going on to TV more. And I think she's been a little bit more aggressive with making sure that people know who she is as a person. I think that will help her. I think that she is a likable person. Not everybody agrees, but I think that doing more to let people see that side of her, I think is going to be helpful going into these last 2 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I know she had a condensed time schedule, but it's a little late. I wonder if she'll go on Rogan because, you know, Trump's doing Rogan sure. tomorrow, and they've been in negotiations to do Rogan as well. And if you want to appeal to a younger demographic, that's the way to go. Yeah. And it'll be interesting to hear Donald Trump on it, and it'd be good. I said this from the outset. She should have done Fox News like right away. Mm-hmm. She'd go into the lion's den right away.
I agree.
And I think they waited too long to turn that around. We're talking with Josh Elliott, a Democratic state rep. Now, we have 5 minutes here, and then we'll have another 3-4 minutes, and then a bigger block. And I have a lot of things to ask you as it relates to Connecticut's finances. So why don't we start on that conversation here? Because at the end of the last session, there were all these needs. And somehow, just somebody in some drawer on the fifth floor, they found a couple hundred million in leftover ARPA money from, you know, the COVID stuff. And that took care of that. But these are not one-time costs, right? So say $150 or $200 million is something that's going to be needed. Again, you're already in the hole for $200 million starting in this next budget. Now, I think, like most of my life, budget talk is just like
boring.
Put me right to sleep. Yeah,
right.
It's totally boring. But now that I understand it a little bit better, it's actually really interesting, especially from a political standpoint. But you have this state that's flush with cash. You got $4 billion in the rainy day fund. You're paying down pension debt.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're staring at a situation where you're going to have a bit of a budget problem. And sort of where do you stand? I mean, what's the starting point here? Like, do you think that we need to change the guardrails? Do you think we need to not accommodate this already increase in spending? Where are you?
So what the guardrails do essentially helps us put money towards two places. It helps us put money towards our rainy day fund and our pension obligations. Now, we have increasingly jumped that percentage up to how much we want stashed away to now 18%. It was 15% just a couple of years ago. And we are just about fully fleshed out, which also puts us in one of the top 5 states in the U.S. in terms of per capita money that we put away. So we're in a really good position there.
Right.
In the 08-09 crash, we had about $1.2 billion. Within the span of a year, we went down to $200 million very quickly, very scary. We had to start cutting core programs. Now, we don't have to put money towards a rainy day program anymore because we have that $4 billion. Now we have to put money away towards $40 billion worth of pension obligations. Now, we've put about $40 billion away over the last 20 years, so we've been doing a good job. But that $40 billion that we need to put away, that still puts us in the bottom quarter of the pack in terms of the rest of the U.S. So we still have a lot of work to do. The question becomes, how quickly do we want to put money away towards these pension obligations? Now, if we do it at the rate we're doing it, it's looking to be about year 2045 or so that we're finally out of the hole and we're 100% funded. The question is, do we also want to be making investments in the state? And the problem is that in 08-09, we stopped looking at our nonprofits, we stopped looking at transportation, we stopped looking at education as core services, and we could just cut as we wanted. It used to be that those services could not be
cut. Untouchable.
Untouchable. And now they are. And because of that, over the last 15 years, we've been making these very slow disinvestments. The problem is that you don't grow the economy and you don't help people out while you are not putting money towards these things. And I do think that there is a place for Connecticut to be making investments to grow our economy. And so that's what we're talking about now when we talk about these guardrails, is how far do we want them to go? We have 3 basic caps. There's a spending cap, revenue cap, volatility cap. But then we also very recently just put into some bond covenants and the bonds that we get from the market, saying that we will not make any changes to the aforementioned 3 caps. So it basically ties our hands to even make changes. We need 60% of the legislature. We need the governor's okay to make these changes.
So, I mean, we only have a minute left in this segment because the concern with tweaking it is that it just it's an incrementalism
fear
that you're going to just creep and creep and creep and creep. It does. I do think the conversation is interesting because a lot of like the 15, 18% of the volatility cap, those were sort of arbitrarily set up. There was no formula that said, oh, this will get us this and this is why we need
this. There's no formula for any of this.
Right.
This is all just here's how we feel. Now, there's a really strong argument, I think, especially with the volatility cap specifically.
Yep.
If the idea is that we don't want to rely on volatile revenue because it's too hard to forecast out how much we're going to need and how much we're going to take in, then what you do is you take a 5-year running average and benchmark it to that. Mm. That makes sense to me.
Yeah, and also, you know, in the 7-8 years, the volatility hasn't been that volatile. It's been,
at all.
You know,
at all.
Which is something, and again, the stock market's been gangbusters. So, I mean, I think a lot of that stuff is influence, and I don't think it'll be that way in perpetuity, but clearly it's been, there's never been an issue. I mean, the volatility cap has been consistent. It's brought in a ton of money.
Well,
quickly.
All I was going to say is that there have been changes made during the Trump presidency that happened after the 2017 budget deal. And what ended up happening was that it literally meant that a chunk of that quote unquote volatile revenue becomes non-volatile, having nothing to do with the stock market at all. Great.
You laid it out there just fine. But is your point that you are in favor of moving the goalposts a little on the volatility cap?
That's right.
Okay.
I would be in favor of making adjustments to all the caps, although I will say with a caveat that the revenue cap I do think is the most important. What the revenue cap just says is that you need to raise about 1.25% more than you say you're going to spend. I do think some sort of buffer is really important. The problem is with our spending cap, it was arbitrarily set decades and decades and decades ago, and it doesn't take into account if you need to make larger investments.
Convince the people out there who were very aware of what happened between 08 and 17.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can even go through like 20 until stuff really kicked in and said, promise, how do I know you're not going to chip away, we're going to hit a recession and we're screwed?
Right. So first of all, we're at 18%, which is the amount that
that's
we wanted
the rainy day
for
fund.
The rainy day, yep. Fund. So that's the real issue when it comes to making sure that we're not screwed when things go poorly. And we can certainly make cuts as
we want to save
cuts.
You from yourself. That's basically what I want to be confident that you're not going to want to keep spending at a rate that eventually we're going to be back in trouble again.
Right. The big problem really is that we had about 80 years where we were putting literally $0 away towards our pension
obligations. That's not the only reason we were in a budget mess. That just means we were in a lot of trouble long term with our pension obligations.
Oh, it's a
and servicing
big
the
reason.
And I know servicing the debt is expensive, yeah. But that's not the only reason we were in such a fiscal mess.
I disagree. That is the reason. That's the reason, because what was happening was every year that number was getting to be a larger and larger percentage of our budget, to the point where
just to service the debt.
Just to service the debt. And so and now what we're doing is we're trying to pay for past sins, pay for the current workforce and paying it forward. So we're doing like triple duty right now. That is the problem.
Does the leadership agree with you? And is this going to be, because not only is the budget going to be a battle, this looks like it'll be a battle, but it's a battle. You dominate the numbers so much that if this wants to, if Democrats want to change it, it'll get changed.
So yes and no. So of course we have the executive branch, we're the governors, we have
the
legislative
branch. Will the governor sign it?
Yeah, of course. So there's a couple issues. First is that the House and the Senate are not in alignment. The Senate has historically been really progressive on issues of the budget. And so they are on one side of the coin. Then you have the governor who comes in.
What side of the coin is the Senate on?
So that is
they want to change
making corrections to the caps, okay, to the guardrails, to allow for more spending.
Okay.
And then you have the other side of the coin, which is really the governor's office, which came in on the heels of the budget changes that we made in 2017, which is when Malloy was in. So it was Malloy and myself with the legislature that were making these that deals that have really solidified the caps that we have. So the governor wants to keep those.
So he's less likely to want to change things.
Doesn't want to change things.
Correct.
Period. Not even less likely. Just doesn't want to.
And you want to, but your
now,
colleagues in the House don't.
We have the House,
yeah,
which in and of itself as a body is pretty split. Now, we certainly have a simple majority of people that would want to make changes, but because the governor doesn't want it, we need either 60% to make changes to that bond covenant, which I mentioned, or we need 2/3 because we need a super majority to over override the governor if we come to some sort of consensus. We're not at two-thirds.
If you could get there, are people going to try? Will people try to get there? Are people willing to try and dunk on the governor on this?
We'll see. So let's just look at the numbers. We have 98 Democrats in the House. We have 53 Republicans. So we need 101 to have the 67 or so percent
to override the veto.
So we would need every single Democrat plus the Republicans. We're not close to there. I would say the moderate caucus has on any given issue between 20 to 25 people. So we really are around like 55 to 60 Democrats that would be more interested in looking at changing these guardrails.
Right. And Lamont doesn't do a lot of work at the State House, but he would do a lot of work to kill that, I bet.
Yes, he would. You don't have to do a lot of work to say, I'm actually not in favor of that. Your word as a governor holds a lot of sway over the legislative work, and you can kill something before we even begin the conversation. That said, there is a lot of desire, both from the Senate and from a lot of leadership in the House, to make these changes. And to a degree, because we're coming into next year with probably close to $200 million hole, we have to look at how we can raise some revenue.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I want to talk about it more, but there's too many other topics we have to get to in our last block, and we'll have to wait. And you know, obviously, you'll come on again before the session starts.
Of course.
Yeah. We're enjoying our time with Josh Elliott, Democrat state rep from Hamden. I do want to ask you, you know, you said something when we're off mic, you know, because taxation, you know, I'm middle class. I would say upper middle class, but I'm definitely middle class. I can't afford college for my kids, and my wife and I both work full time, and you know, we really, really work hard to try to do the things in life that we have to and want to. And I feel like the middle class pays for everything. We pay for college, we don't get help. You know, like in college, it's either someone can pay all of it or none of it, and they're fine, and we pay the most. And it's the same with the taxation. So I'm just curious. You mentioned something about taxes that you think we're not fairly taxed. Can you just explain to people what you mean by that?
Sure. There are three main taxes that you're going to be paying in the state of Connecticut. You're paying the income tax, you're paying the state tax, and you're paying the property tax. So the sales tax and the income tax both go to the state. Property tax is local. And it's the property tax and sales tax that are the worst taxes. They hit the middle class and working poor the hardest. And so over the last 15 years or so, we put three studies out every 5 years or so that shows that the more money you make in our state, the less you pay as a percentage of your income to state and local taxes. That combines all those taxes. So yes, the progressive income tax is that as you make more money, you're paying a little bit more, but it's pretty flat generally. It could be much more progressive. And that's what I'd like to see, because what I want to happen is...
You mean the more you make, the more you pay type thing?
That's correct. But what ends up happening is because the sales tax and the property tax are so onerous on the middle class and working poor, that ends up flipping in terms of the overall amount of money that you pay to being an inverse proportion, so that you pay less the more that you make. And that's because when you're owning real estate, it's not attached to your income. And when you're paying for your daily goods, it's not attached to your income. So it's a much larger percentage of your income when you're paying taxes on those things.
So what would you do?
So what I would like to do is two things. First, make sure that we send more money back to municipalities. And CCM has, and for the first time, agreed to this general premise of that the state needs to be helping out municipalities more. And that's for education, and that's for transportation, and that's for certainly our police force and our firefighters.
So that'll put less pressure on this, on the town
those higher property taxes. And then ultimately what you have to do, and this is the unpopular bit, is you have to ask the wealthy to pay a little bit more. And my argument is, if you're in the bottom half of the income distribution, you're paying upwards of like 20% of your income to state and local taxes. And if you're in the top 10%, you're paying about 8%. And that is, to me, deeply unfair.
Yeah, it's just hard to get that passed. But I think on a logical standpoint, I mean, we pay a high, huge percentage. I mean, the middle class, we're not sophisticated enough to dodge it, and we got to pay full freight. We're talking with Josh Elliott. So, you know, is it safe to say that you've been on the record that if Lamont doesn't run, you would run for governor?
It's something that I'm interested in. The reason I have to be so careful is that if I'm definitive in any way, you trigger a campaign, and then all of a sudden you have to open up an entity and you have to start filing with the SEC. So I want to be clear. It's something that I would be interested in, and then we'll see what happens depending on what our current governor does. Because certainly I would have no interest in challenging our current governor. I think he's doing a good job on the whole.
So... And I feel like there are very few people I talk to, and I ask this question to just about everybody.
Sure.
There are one or two, but most people think that he's leaning toward running again.
I think if you asked me 6 months ago, I would have told you about 60-40 that he's not going to run, and now I'm going to tell you about 70-30 that he is going to run.
What's changed, do you think?
I think that he's just having a good time. I have heard rumors that he's getting a lot of support from family to keep on going and to not hang it up yet. I think for him, and this is, you know, playing armchair psychologist, but he wants to keep, again, these guardrails intact, and he wants to protect his legacy, which in many ways is really Malloy's legacy, because he was the one that put a lot of these predictions in place.
Yeah, but he didn't put them in place. He was forced to. I mean, let's be honest about it, right? It was a negotiation because the Republicans had enough mojo to push back. So, well, I don't know Malloy, and I don't have an axe to grind or support him, but I wouldn't say the impetus came from him.
That is fair. I mean, the big thing that Malloy wanted to do before he left office was to make changes to the way that we put money towards teachers' retirements, because right now the state is on the hook and the towns are not. And so that means that towns that are a little bit wealthier can ramp up how much they're paying their teachers, and they know that the back end is actually going to be borne out by the state, and that seems pretty unfair. At the same time, teachers' unions are like, well, this is how we can ensure that we will have the money that that we're being guaranteed. And so there was a lot of push-pull there. This was the thing that Malloy wanted to accomplish before he left, and nobody in the Democratic or Republican side were buying. And so that is how we ended up going months and months and months past session, not having a budget. And then it was the legislature that came together to essentially do it over Malloy. So that is a fair point.
You know, he's 70 now. So I guess he, at the end of his third term, he'd be like 76. But I guess, I mean, if the budget projections from what I've seen, why wouldn't you stay if you're going to be in the black?
If you're going to be having a fun time and it doesn't really cost anything.
And you're popular.
And you're popular, sure.
Who's the congressperson for your district?
Rosa DeLauro is my congresswoman.
I feel like there's going to be massive turnover. I think this should be the last term for Larson, Courtney, Blumenthal.
Should or will.
DeLauro, you know what I mean?
I mean,
would you ever entertain one, like, if she stepped back, where you want to be? Because you're used to being one cog in a big engine,
right?
So you wouldn't be frustrated per se with the 435 people in Congress.
I would say that there is a big difference in quality of life between having to go to DC and go back and forth and making that 40-minute drive to Hartford.
Okay.
That, to me, is the differentiating factor. It consumes you in a different way that being a state representative consumes you.
So that's
and
no.
I love our state. Yeah. I want to be here. I left for college. I was away for a few years, but I came back happily, and I'm here happily. So I don't see the need to go back and forth.
It's good to see you, man.
You as well.
You had a good summer?
I had a primary.
Oh, yeah, you had to fight off a primary.
I'm trying to make my summer happen now. So I'm going on vacation. Oh, so I went to the Azores with my girlfriend.
Not bad.
We were in Vermont recently, went to the Finger Lakes to visit some friends. So I've been trying to make it work.
We'll talk to you again soon.
I would love to come back.